Hey folks, I think we're making a start, so welcome along. I'm Greg, for those that don't know me, originally a Queenslander, sadly, but now currently residing in Melbourne. So I keep hearing that the trend is always the other way, but you know, that's what I've done. So but I have sort of started to head back a little bit in the middle. Sort of just bought some land north of Coffs Harbour, so I think it's kind of somewhere between. So we'll see how it goes. So look, I'm a data platform MVP. This is people that used to be called SQL Server MVPs. And part of the RD program, the RDs here, there's Adam Kogan, myself, Neil Rudin, Oren Thomas, a couple of guys here locally, just a little bit more across a variety of technologies at times, involved with the SQL Server product line since about 1992, so it was sort of long enough to have a love-hate relationship with everybody in the, most of the people in the team, and do a bit of writing and things like that, head up a company called SQL Down Under. Now look, what I wanted to do in this session, we thought right at the beginning of the event, there are an awful lot of people who haven't really looked at Azure Machine Learning or Stream Analytics or DocumentDB or some of these services, and they are in the sort of data territory, so we sort of want to make sure that you really are across what they are, and in particular because there are sessions on these things, some other ones during the week, and so it'll at least give you an idea whether it's something that you then want to go and have a look at as well. So the ones I want to cover off, so SQL database first up, and this, yeah, a lot of people say, yeah, I've looked at that. And it's actually gone through a lot of changes in the last, probably most in the last 6 months is where most of the changes have occurred. And I really want to call out a little bit about A, why you'd use it in the first place, but presuming you're largely across that, I then want to just take a bit of a look at what has changed lately with it, and just so you have an idea where the directions are there. DocumentDB, have a look at that. Again, that's one that went generally available earlier in the year, and a fair degree of interest actually instantly appeared, and had a lot of resources and things appeared immediately with the product, which I thought was good. Machine learning is a kind of an evolution of the data mining areas, and an area I think can make a significant contribution to a lot of organizations. Stream analytics is, I'd probably in some weird way say it's an evolution of what was in Stream Insight, which appeared around the SQL Server 2008 R2 timeframe. But I don't think many people probably widely used. Did anybody in the room actually use Stream Insight? Yeah, bits of, hands. Look, I think this is now a much more practical thing for people to use, and I'm starting to see it used fairly rapidly. It's quite good. And Power BI, of course, has become the sort of the analytic option at the back end of a lot of this. I also want to show you just and point you at a number of other areas that I think you should really go and have a look at. So first up, look, just with SQL database, you've got a lot of choices how you deploy SQL Server into applications. If you look at a lot of the original discussion that went around SQL DB, what I used to see, the whole discussion was focused on, hey, I can do this on-premises. What is it I can't do when I go to SQL DB? That was the kind of discussion that was going on. This has changed dramatically now. And so pretty much the product has come almost on parity with what's going on in the on-premises product. But in a number of cases, it's gone well past what's available in the current box product. And so I want to show you where that's sitting. And importantly, why you might want to think about that for more sort of, I think more greenfield applications, as well as pick up and move some existing ones. But really the main target, I think, for this is certainly building new ones. The provisioning on demand is an important thing. The being able to sort of choose the performance level is important, and also the ability to change that as time goes on. And so one of the challenges that I see with any on-premises deployment is you never know what to buy, right? And there's always this sort of scenario that if you don't buy enough, you go broke. If you buy too much, you go broke. And so the whole reason you want to do that for sort of cloud-based resources applies very much the same in the databases. Also with that, Instead of spending your time trying to work out, you know, how do I deploy appropriate high availability, how do I build in sort of disaster recovery features and so on, you're really much better off managing at the level where you say, this is the level I want to achieve, rather than spending your time trying to work out how to actually do that, right? If I look at a good example even of these, if I look at something like Office 365, companies I worked at previously where we had Exchange and Link and things on premises, I remember what we went through to try and get, say, Federation set up with Microsoft so we could share free busy calendars and so on. It was a mess trying to get that going. By comparison with Office 365, I've gone in, checked a box, and it's worked ever since. I haven't got a clue how it works, right? But really, that's the level I want to manage at, is I want that capability, right? Rather than let me go off and try and work out how to provide that. And it's the same with the databases. Companies really don't want to know about operating systems and service packs and patches and things like that. In the end, you are way better off to eventually try and target a situation where you have a T-SQL endpoint you talk to. You're really just saying, how fast has this got to be? What sort of HA and DR requirements do I need? And so on, and specifying that at a management level rather than being involved in the whole, how do I do this? Elastic pools have given us the ability to start doing queries across databases and to pool the resources from a number of databases. The built-in HA and DR options, again, vary by tier, and so do the security and compliance options. One of the things that I find interesting, I hear a lot of people in a lot of the cloud areas, whenever I start talking to companies, you get this sort of, I'm worried about the security of my data, I'm worried about things like that, and I get that. But look, on their worst day, I've visited data centers, and look, on their worst day, they do a far better job than any company I've ever walked into, including, you know, some of the very high-end companies here in Australia. So, I mean, who are we kidding? You know, like, you really have to stop and think, you know, am I going to do a better job than that? And, you know, where they have people who are completely focused on meeting every certification, every standard, and so on. I go into banks and things, and they're struggling to meet the requirements themselves, right, even at that level, let alone companies down below that, right? And so I have a feeling down the track, you're going to be pushed into these sort of systems because they're the only ones that will meet the certifications as the ante keeps getting upped in terms of what's required. Now, in terms of the connection model, we end up with servers are provisioned underneath subscriptions. The server is very much a logical server. There have been a couple of different versions of the server. There's currently a V12 server is the one you should be provisioning under at the moment. When the clients connect, you've really got two options. You've still got a kind of a logical concept of a master database, which you can put logins into. But as well as that, you've got users that are authenticated at the database level, like the sort of the contained users. The one that I think will end up being the most common in future, though, is you can now use your Active Directory as part of Azure as the authenticator for the databases. And so what this means is that if you either have Azure Active Directory spun up as a separate item, or if you have Office 365 in place, you'll have Active Directory there for Office 365. And what that means is you can now use your Office 365 credentials to now sort of log on into Azure SQL database. And this is changing how a lot of things work. The same will end up happening with the on-premises as well. If you look at V12, though, it's already the core engine is on largely on parity with the database, with the on-premises product. But what's important is it's already on parity with what's coming in SQL Server 2016. So out of the box today, we already have row-level security, data masking, you know, a lot of the elastic queries and things like that. They're already in the product available in SQL Database. And this is a fundamental shift in how things are going. So previously, as I said, all the discussion was what isn't there. Now what's happening is every one of these things, when they're rolling it out, they're putting it into Azure SQL Database first. It's then getting rapid turnaround and feedback on that, and then eventually it's ending up rolled into the on-premises product. So it becomes really interesting that instead of having an on-premises product that the day it comes out has got a whole lot of new stuff that nobody has really tried, all of these things have been in the same code base and being tried for quite some period of time now in Azure SQL database. The surface area has got a lot better, so at the higher end, partitioning, parallel queries, things that weren't there before, online and large index rebuilds, large was a problem before, SQL CLR is there now, spatial's there, full text indexing is there, just appeared about a month or two ago, change tracking has now made its way in there, and they've also now got in-memory column store, and in the premium it's all moved to solid state drives sitting underneath the databases as well. So if you look at the tiers, we've got basic, standard, and premium currently now. The main thing that they differ on are the range of performance that's available, and obviously the price, changes quite a bit. And as well, it determines the high availability and disaster recovery options that you have available. So for example, in standard edition, or the standard tier, we have simple geo-replication of the data. When you get to premium, you have the ability to have multiples of those, and you have the ability to have read-only copies in the other locations as well, and so on. So the same basic core functionality is there, but you start to get a number of additional things in terms of that. The programming surface says they're 2014, but I'd have to say now, as I said, it's getting much, much closer to 2016. Large amounts of 2016 code is already there. And they had to have a way, if you're going to sort of deploy systems and you're going to sort of specify what you want declaratively, rather than saying, I want this sort of speed disk, this sort of whatever, they had to have a way of measuring that. And so database throughput units are where they've come up with their own measure, where they're trying to have a measure of here's CPU, here's memory, here's disk throughput, and so on. And they've tried to have a situation where if you have something that has a DTU value that's twice another DTU value, then it roughly should get through about twice as much work, right? Now, clearly, that's a rough estimate because it depends on the workload as to how that's going to work. But the idea is that you just simply spin up or down the size of the number that you're looking for. Elastic queries have appeared a lot over the last couple of months. One of the big issues I had with Azure SQL DB when it first appeared was I had no way of getting data from one database to another SQL DB without going through a sort of a VM or SSIS or something like that involved separately, or as I said, like a separate VM. That's now no longer the case. I can now build external data sources and build external tables in SQL DB and sort of directly access data. Now, it doesn't have to just be other Azure SQL databases. It can be HD Insight. It can be sort of Hadoop-style stuff. You can use the same mechanisms to get to that. But the most common place where I use it today is to get to another Azure SQL database. They also have the ability to do elastic jobs, where we can take a query and run it across a whole lot of databases. And there's a whole lot of work going on to try and make it easier and easier to manage large numbers of databases, which will be commonplace. And I mentioned before, security and compliance. Auditing appeared back in the product a while back, transparent database encryption a couple of months ago, and recently row-level security, all was encrypted, new encryption options, and dynamic data masking. I'll show you a couple of these. Let's have a look. All right. So I'll pop into the portal here. So I'll sort of start off in the normal Azure portal. Let me grab. Now, one of the things you have to get used to here is that they are sort of halfway between changing between the two portals. And so there are some things that are in the old portal and some things that are in the new portal. The new portal is a much better experience, but as I said, everything's not there yet. Now, in the case of this, I've got, you can do the databases and servers and things like that in here. I'll leave it for now because I need to use it a bit later for machine learning and so on. But the rest of the time, I'll just spend in here for the moment in the new portal. So if I switch across to the new portal, this has gone had a lot of work done on it over the last couple of months as well. What I found with the new portal, at first it was kind of flashy, and things like this picture used to occupy two-thirds of the screen. I used to think, well, I couldn't care less, you know, what was going on in Brazil. You know, like, it'd be nice to know, but in the end, I'm interested in, you know, my services, and I'd only be interested in that if it was one of mine, right? They've got more focused on this, and the interaction across the different blades and things has improved out of sight in the last couple of months. Typically, I start with all resources, and so if I start in all resources, I've got a database here and a database server. So the database server is one with a little sort of cog shown on there. Now, a couple of things have changed in this database server as well. First thing is that you didn't used to be able to pick the name of the server, right? Now, the reason they did that originally is, you can imagine, as soon as they released it, everybody wanted a server called Coca-Cola and Pepsi and, you know, all those sorts of things. And they went, hang on. You know, that was not some new namespace that people were going to go and start claiming names in or something. So they started first up sort of allocating names that you couldn't pick. Still in the old portal, you can't pick the names. In the new portal, you can now sort of specify the names of the servers and so on again. So it's an example of something that is different there. In this case, I've got a V12 server. This one in place, you need to have the firewall rules set up. This is in Australia Southeast, which is the Melbourne data center. Couple of databases sitting under this one, and most of the rest here, a couple of things I'll show you. First is the latest database update, and that's the one that, if you go into this, this is the one that basically allows you to move up to version 12. So if you're not currently running V12 servers, this is the one you need to sort of choose, and it'll give you a, hey, you need to agree to all this, and we're going to go and move it across. Now, I've already done that, so. The other thing in here that is in preview is Active Directory Admin, and so this is the one where you can use your Azure Active Directory credentials to then be authenticating into the databases and so on in here. So the server has to have that enabled before you can do that. All right. Let me connect with Management Studio. And so, first thing I want to do here, I've connected to my normal engine, but I'll just show you here. I'll connect across to that same one. So I've got a list of servers here. I've got popcorncraze.database.windows.net. Now, what I often do with these, I often go and set an alias up for those, and I'll show you that in a sec, because I just find it makes it a lot easier if you're working all the time with these from Management Studio. Got a couple of databases sitting inside here. Let me drill in. I'll just show you quickly here. So stuff that we couldn't have done before. Now, an example here. So the thing is, we've now got sort of the, you know, spatial data types and stuff are now part of this and work just absolutely fine. An example of that, if we look here. So let me just make a connection to that. So I'm going to sort of select from cities where city is Gold Coast. I've got a table here that's just got all the cities in Australia that have at least 1,000 people in it. And you sort of look at the location and go, okay, well, that's really interesting. But the detail for that, if you want to come along on Thursday, I'll sort of show you through a whole lot of the spatial stuff. But to give you an idea here, this is if I select all the cities. So this is all of the cities that have at least 1,000 people and if they're a major transport hub, but when, same as on-premises, any time it sees spatial data in the results, it'll pop a spatial results tab in. And so if you look at this, this isn't actually a map, it's actually just a dot, you know, where there's at least 1,000 people, right, in this one, which is kind of interesting. And clearly this is unpleasant, you know, out here, no risk at all. Actually, I love, have many people read Bill Bryson's books at all? A few, yeah. The one he had on Australia, I absolutely love that. He noted the fact that we tend to name things after explorers that weren't very good. You know, instead of like the book, you know, people went out and died. You know, that's actually not hard to do, you know, in Australia. So, anyway, actually, one that I particularly liked as well, he was talking, he was in some New South Wales country town, and it had one radio station, of course, was the ABC. And they were calling the test cricket. You can just imagine. You know, it was a long periods of silence, and then a ball is bowled. You know, so just, He loved Australia. No risk. Anyway, so the now what I've got here then, of course, is I can do the same sort of stuff. So again, I've got location. Out of that, get me the latitude, get me the longitude, and so on. You know, these sort of queries. I can do the basic spatial queries. Right. Now, what I want to show you, a couple of new things, though. So first up, row-level security. Now, this one's sort of an interesting mix. So what it is there's a lot of ISVs and people who have, say, tenants in the one database, and they're trying to make sure that people don't get, obviously, to the data they shouldn't get to. And so what they've done in 2016, SQL Server, and is already here in Azure SQL DB, is I can define a security function, and so I just created a schema called security. So I've said check local cities only, and so I've got a members table that says which city they live in. And so what I want to do here, I've returned a table saying, look, select one if it's DBO, or if the distance to Melbourne, or the distance to Gold Coast, actually, I changed it to, and the distance to Gold Coast is less than 100 Ks, right? So the idea is to say, maybe people can only look at local ones. So let me pop that in there. In fact, it helps to connect to the right database. In fact, I'm going to do that as an admin user. All right, so let me create that function. Now, so the idea here is if I pick up some city IDs, and so I've got here ones with gold in them. So I've got Gold Coast 1859, and I've got Goldsworthy 739. And so what I'm doing just to test the function is I've said, look, go and get the username, and so that's DBO, no surprise. And then I've said, look, go and check whether I'm allowed to get to that city. And so in this case, it's one because I'm a DBO. But if I temporarily grant select permission to another user, Cinema app, and then I execute as that user, and then go off and sort of run the query, then you know it's saying, hey, they can get to the Gold Coast, but they can't get to Goldsworthy, which is further away. Right? So I'll revert that back out. Now, the thing that does the magic, once we have the in fact, I'll revoke the select on the function as well. The thing that does the magic is adding a security policy. And so I've said here, look, create security policy. And this is a local cities filter. And I've said, add a filter predicate. You can do filter predicates and blocking predicates. But I've said, use the filter predicate, call this function, and pass this column in from the table on the members table. And this is turned on. Okay. So this is how it gets attached in. If I then sort of select from that, of course, you know, I'll see all of them. In fact, there are 5,000 odd there. But if I connect as Cinema app now, basically that shouldn't happen. So if I execute as Cinema app and we go off and have a look, you know, it's now, it's run, and there's 145 come back from that. In fact, and so if I join to the city, so I can sort of see what that is, then that'll sort of bring me back and sort of grab the city details as well. And you'll notice they're all like, you know, Bow Desert, Beenleigh, and so on. So that sort of works just fine. And so all the user is doing is saying select from the table, and it's clearly just filtering the rows that they're going to see. Okay, another one I want to show you is that if I have a query here where I've got a members table, let me just connect as that application. And so I'll connect as Cinema app. And go off and sort of query the members table. And I see the members, but notice I've got a bunch of credit card numbers sitting in here, which again, you know, yes, no, don't do that. All right. But the thing I could do as an example of masking is now I can go in and sort of dynamically change this. So if I go back over here and sort of grab the database, and then pop down here to dynamic data masking. And what it's saying, it's sort of suggesting here, it's gone off and looked at columns and gone, you know, this might be something you want to think about masking. Well, yeah, okay, maybe not. But if I say, look, add a mask, and then it's saying, look, to where? And so I'll say, look, in the members table, so I'll grab members, and say the credit card number. So I want that. And what I do is I pick a mask, and I've got a mask in here designed for credit cards. And so if I save that and save the masking, that'll sort of push that out. And then just by making that change, now when I run this, so notice I've now got the sort of, without changing the query, I've now got sort of mask data coming back as part of that instead. And so I can go through and build a variety of masks to work against different types of data in here. The other one I want to show you, just while we're in here, there's also, I've got the ability to query data in other databases. And just I want to show you this, the syntax of this, because it's probably new. So notice I can say create external data source, spatial DB, with type is a remote relational database. There's where the server lives. That's the name of the database, and this is the credential. You have to have already created a database scoped credential, which is a new type of object as well. And then once I do that, oh, let's actually go into the right place. That'd be good. Go back as a PPK admin. Now, what this is going to head into is I've got a second database over here called Spatial, and I've built a view over the top of that, and I've sort of created the external table based on that view. So let's grab that. And then, so that's my data source. Then what I do is I say create an external table, which I've called country data, where here are the columns that are over in that other database, and then with that data source. And once I do that, then basically I can go and select from this like it's a table. First time you do it, takes a moment sometimes. But basically it'll connect across to the other as your SQL DB and bring the data back. And as I said, this same logic can be done with Hadoop and other things in here as well. And in fact, this one had the shape of the data as text, and so I can, you know, go in here and say, look, geom from text, call the geometry methods, go back and get that data and convert that to an actual location, you know, and I'm back to, you know, here's a set of spatial results, you know, this sort of thing. And drop the table, and I'll drop the data source. Cool. So look, there's just a few of the things that have changed in SQL Database in the last little while. So next one I want to mention is DocumentDB. Now, where this one comes from is there's a whole lot of people want a document store, predominantly a JSON document store, and they don't want to use a traditional database for it. And a big part of that is the schema. They really don't want to have to predefine a schema. And often, in a lot of cases, the problem is the schema is going to be different for each of the documents that's contained in the database. So this is a fundamental difference from a traditional database. And so what this is a NoSQL database, but a JSON database as a service. You get to query over sort of schema-free data. You get to define, again, pick the performance level. It's an indication of where things are going, though. It's automated indexing on this one. And so imagine, again, because you're not saying how the schema of the data is laid out, the question is, how would you do indexing, right? And so they have a completely automated indexing service that learns the whole time. You can do some tweaks to decide what does get indexed and how quickly. And you can also decide the consistency as to, like, eventual consistency or strong. But in the end, that's the level you're doing it at, not let me go and build this index. It's also got, I'll show you the objects that live underneath that. So what you've got here is the top level thing is an account. Then we have databases, so it is a concept of a database inside that. These ones are only in the new portal, DocumentDB. It doesn't exist in the old portal at all. At the database level, there are users. Users have permissions on collections. A collection is the thing that contains documents, so it's a collection of documents, and documents can have attachments associated with them. One of the things that's kind of interesting is it also has a concept of stored procs, triggers, and user-defined functions. Now, when the application issues a query, they've come up with a sort of a SQL-like language. It's very, very like sequel, but it's not totally sequel like you know it. So I'm endlessly fascinated when I go along to developer sessions for the last 20 years when they keep saying sequel's disappearing, and yet I keep seeing it appear in nearly every new product. You know, so I think some knowledge of sequel won't do you any harm, you know, going forward. But anyway, so note the documents that this is looking at. So I've got four documents there. The shape of them is quite different. And in fact, you could have nested documents inside the documents as well. And then what's returned back is a lump of JSON. And so a collection is the thing that holds the documents. It's not a table. It's one of the things people struggle to get their head around at first. They think of it like it's a table, but it's not. And it's simply because each of the documents could have a completely different layout. So we don't enforce the schema. It's also the boundary at the moment for storage. So it's up to 10 gig per collection. It's also, I might add, a transaction boundary. Now, the procedural code you write is not .NET. It's JavaScript that lives inside here. It's scoped to the collection, so you can build, as I said, procs, triggers, and user-defined functions. You do have transactional control at the collection level, so it's not across collections, but you do get the sort of atomicity, consistency, isolation, durability type properties at the collection level. And the triggers, they have both pre and post triggers. It's not just after triggers. Now, when you configure this, you also configure how consistent you want the data to be. Now, what they do is you have an option there from strong, session, bounded, and eventual, right? And so the idea is that when you're writing, the tighter you have the consistency, or the stronger the consistency, the more latency you're going to put into the writing process. If you're doing reads, the weaker the consistency, obviously the higher the throughput you're going to get through the application. Now, there are some tools. They're very early stage at the moment. So one of the things that is available is a Document DB Explorer, which is like a mini management studio, but that's a project up at CodePlex. So it's not sort of a separate sort of shipping thing like Management Studio is today. All right, let me quickly show you that. All right, now this one, what I want to show you here is a way you could start to learn to use this. And one of the things I really like is they've built a DocumentDB query playground. And so this means you can start playing around with DocumentDB without installing anything and so on. So the idea here, there's a sandbox, let me start here. SQL looking query, where I can say select Aster from food. And we run the query, and that'll return us back a set of documents. And notice it's JSON, the structure that comes back. And what they've got here in the playground then, so syntax-wise, another example. So go off and grab food, where food group is snacks. This looks pretty familiar, right? Food ID, description, so on. I said it's sort of SQL-ish. And we run that, and no surprise what comes back. Filtering, where clauses are very, again, SQL-ish looking stuff most of the time. So this is a food manufacturer name is Coca-Cola. In and between, both there. So in and between, sort of operating as you'd expect. They've curiously only recently added order by, which sort of seems like something you'd expect might have been there from day one, but it hasn't. An example there, so they've gone order by, and notice this, they've said, look, in food, go down servings, grab the first of the servings, and get the weight in grams, and then order by that, right? Now, the thing that's interesting with this is, of course, that'll run even if the data you're hitting doesn't have those columns, right? So it'll end up with null on anything you query that isn't there. But this is very different to a database. So I can sort of run the query, and as long as I've kind of followed the rules of the language and not specified something, you know, totally bizarre, what I'm going to get back is its best attempt, and if I sort of drill down to something that isn't there, it just goes, it's not there, right? It doesn't go, you know, that thing doesn't exist somewhere inside here, quite to the same level. If I screw up the syntax, let's drop something out and run it, what I get back, apart from being red, is I get a lump of JSON again, which is the thing that sort of wraps the error message tucked inside that. And finally, they've recently added a bunch of geospatial stuff in here as well. And so select ASTA from volcanoes, where distance, location of the volcano from a type, and this is the location of Redmond, where Microsoft is. So basically saying less than 100 Ks from Redmond, where it was a stratovolcano and was in the period 1800 to 1899, right? So this is coming from a volcano database. And now again, so basically these queries run. The results, again, are JSON, but because that sort of contained coordinates and stuff in the data coming back, they've just sort of mapped that out in a map for us. And so anyway, look, I'd strongly encourage you to simply go up and have a play around in the Azure DocumentDB thing in this playground. The nice thing is you can play and build and do all sorts of stuff in there without even installing anything, right? So that'll be sort of a good start for getting used to that. All right. Told you we had lots of things to talk about today. So next one's machine learning. Now, how many made use of data mining in the previous SQL Server on a couple of people? Not many, all right. Let's have a look. So look, the aim of any of this sort of thing is basically to take previous knowledge and use it to learn where things might go in the future. There are two basic ways this is done, but there's a whole lot of places this gets used. And so a good example is churn analysis, right? And I was talking to actually one of the guys at lunchtime today about this. One of the airlines locally with a big red tail on it, but the thing is that for about 10 years I was like platinum on them, and I got to a point about 2 years ago where I go, I'm not flying with them anymore, right? Decided that. Now, if someone's flying a couple of times a week with the airline, the question is at what point do they notice that you've changed, right? And if you think about it, when could they fix that situation? They could fix it within a few weeks of it happening, probably, right? But what happens is they don't notice. At the end of the year, they send a thing going, you know, Greg, look, you didn't fly as much this year, but, you know, based on past things, we'll still keep you at the same tier. Next year, you spend the whole year not flying at all, and then they go, you didn't fly as much. We'll just sort of move you down a tier, you know, and so on. And sort of year after year, it's like, okay, but still not a single person has ever dealt with the what happened, you know? And I look at that and go, you know, even though they always talk about the fact it's much harder to get people back than it is to avoid losing them in the first place, customers. And imagine the alternative where if they worked out what the things were that tended to cause people to have a problem, and then they started to detect other people who were having the same sorts of problems, they could, you know, randomly do something nice for them, yeah? Or something like that. And it's amazing the outcome that would have. A lot of social network analysis, again, a very, very common sort of scenario. Recommendations, everybody's been to seeing, you know, the Amazons and things like that. But it's one of the things I often say about BI and why I'd encourage you to get involved is if you look at a company like, say, somebody like Amazon, if I go to their site, you can guarantee the people who do the order processing and invoicing and order handling, I'll bet you that's good, solid IT work, but I'll guarantee you their life is full of head cuts, head counts, budget cuts, things like that. But the guys who do the, you know, you ought to think about buying this, I'll bet their projects are funded at a totally different level, right? Because they can fundamentally alter the profitability of the company, you know? I look at things they recommend, and I almost never used to buy anything they recommend. Now I often buy stuff they recommend. What changed? Right? The only thing that changed is they now do a better job of data mining than they did some years ago. And this is a better place to be. One of the things I often say I like about BI projects as a whole is they tend to appeal to the people who pay the bills, right? And that's a good spot to be doing work. It's just something to think about, you know? And this is a good area to look into. Also in here, location-based systems, vision analytics, weather stuff. Legal is another interesting one. Doing work at the moment with some councils. And what's interesting there is they have, say, fines and you have infringements. So parking fines, animal fines, all those sorts of things. And again, they have good solid IT that looks after that in the back end. Build analytics over the top of it, and now they can see how many do they issue, you know, who pays in time, you know, how many people get sent reminders, how many people pay on the reminders, how many go to court, you know, this sort of thing. And that's all good and fine, and they love that. They absolutely love that. But what fascinates me more is an enormous volume of these things go to court. I had no idea. It's like 30% go to court at the particular council I'm at. And what's even worse is they lose a high percentage of those court cases. Now, everyone they lose costs a fortune. Right? Now, what's much more interesting than the analytics is to try and work out what are the ones we lose, right? And maybe we should just settle those right up, you know, and just have a fuzziness, you know, with keep dialing up or down the level of, you know, what we, but if we can work out the characteristics, like, you know, that parking inspector in that area during that period and so on, he's having a bad week or something, you know, maybe we should settle those, right? This is much more value add to the organization. Equipment monitoring. We're doing work with companies that are doing water supplies down around the Murray and so on. And again, predictive maintenance is a very, very big area in this. Obviously, when you have certain events and things occur and weather patterns and so on, it's really important to get out there and try and fix the stuff before it breaks, you know, things that you know are going to cause a problem. That's much better than running around, you know, when something dies. Advertising ones, so we've got basically all sorts of basic pricing they're suggesting. Fraud detection's a biggie. And of course, personalized insurance. This is one we're all going to hate going forward. But this is where the insurance companies, of course, trying to work out what not to insure you for anything you're likely to have, right? So going forward. So unfortunately, we're going to be the ones helping them do that. All right. So look, there's two basic ways that this is done. So supervised and unsupervised. The deal with supervised learning is we keep having known outcomes and we keep presenting it to the system so it learns. So for example, if I said this is a car and you knew nothing else, right? You might start looking at this and go, cars are, they have wheels, you know, cars have headlights, or cars have windows, or cars have roofs. But the trouble is you might also go, cars are red, right? Or pink, or you know what? So the thing is you start to infer all these different things when you have a small set of data. So then if we look at the next one, we go, oh, okay, hang on, you know, cars aren't red, you know, so they can be different colors, right, and so on. Or then we strike ones without a roof, right, and so on. So the idea is you slowly start building up a knowledge of, you know, that's, and this is what a kid does, right, when they're growing up. They go, that's what a car is. Eventually they learn. It's also important to go, that isn't one. Now, clearly that's a million miles away, but if you have data where you're teaching it that's not one, that's as important as well, particularly where it's close. And then the idea is eventually you're giving it sort of things and saying, which of these are cars, you know? And then it's had to learn enough to be able to make that decision. Whereas unsupervised learning is where we start out with just groups, a bunch of data, and we're saying, go and find the groups that live inside this. Now, it could be the capitalized letters, it could be the color, it could be the letter or number at the end and so on, but something that can sift through that and come back and go, actually, there's two groups of data there, right? We need to be able to somehow apply algorithms to get to that. And so the strengths of what they've built with machine learning, this stuff was hard to provision years ago. So they've built this sort of browser-based environment, all drag and drop. They built a huge number of samples. It's actually a really good story. And also, sorry, the other thing they've done is implement R and Python integration. Now, this sort of feels like the new Microsoft, really. Because these are technologies that were not part of the game previously. R is one that's interesting for you to have a look at if you're in around the data area, because there's deep integration of R coming in SQL Server 2016 as well, sort of directly in the box. So R's going to become more important going forward. There's also a whole lot of it in around Power BI as well. But in the end, you get to build logical decision-making things, and then you can expose them out as web services. So let me show you that. So this one's back in the old portal. And so what I've got is I've got this Azure ML testing here, but this is a machine learning workspace that I've set up. Now, if we drill into this, the main thing that you'd spend all your time doing is working with ML Studio, which is a machine learning studio. Let's open him up. All right, and this gives me a list of my experiments. Now, what an experiment is, say new, and what this brings up, this is a gallery of pre-built bits of logic, and it's really good. So for example, I was talking before about predictive analytic, predictive maintenance and so on. You know, there are in here, for example, a whole bunch of examples of, you know, how to prepare data, how to train regress, and you know, there are lots and lots of experiments pre-built in here to sort of show you how to do that. That's a world of difference to what we had before. But if I just said, look, give me a new blank experiment. Now, if many of you have done work with integration services in the past, it'll almost sort of look a little familiar. I think it's some of the people from the same sort of team involved in building some of this. And what you've got is kind of like a set of tools in here, and we drag them out and start building things. So we can have our own sets of data, or they give a whole set of sample data sets in here. Now, again, that's nice because it allows you to build things, and so all the gallery works, but it also allows you to build things and share things with others with it, you know, where they've got a known set of data. So, for example, if I bring out the adult census income, and we drop this on, now, the first thing I can do is I can visualize just this. And so, if I right-click here, the options are download the data as a CSV or visualize this. And so if I say, look, visualize, that'll just sort of show me what the data looks like at that point. And so notice in here, what I've got is the different columns. It'll give me a little graph for that, show me the sort of values that are sitting inside that. For each one of them, if I click on it, say, let's say marital status, it'll then give me a set of, like a graph down here, sort of showing me, you know, here's the different categories of people that are in that. If I grab some sort of, let's say a numeric thing, hours per week, up here gonna get min, max, standard deviation, unique values, you know, missing values, all those sorts of things in there. So this allows me to sort of drill in and play around with that data. Now what you do with it then, is we then start building out what we need from that. So for example, if I said project, there's a project columns, I drag it out, looks very integration service-ish. I pick this up and notice as I drag it, it highlights where I could drop it. It's showing that that's green, and so it goes, yep, that'll be fine. And what project columns is just which of the columns you're sort of choosing out of that. So I then launch a column selector, and say I want, you know, age, and I want occupation, let's say hours per week and income, something like that. And so, and I could say allow duplicates or not, but I'll say no, okay. And so this is like I just grab the columns that I want. Now, once I do that, though, I can't just sort of right-click and say, show me the data here. Because what I've now built is the beginnings of an experiment. And so I have to run the experiment to be able to sort of then look at the data. So if I say, look, run, this will go off and run. Now, sometimes it takes a while to start running, right? Part of the deal here is there's a free tier that you run this on, and that runs in a sort of a shared capability. Sometimes that can take a moment to start, and sometimes it just seems to start straight away. Once it gets going, it seems to run a fairly quick time. I think from memory, an experiment has to run within an hour completely to fit inside the free tier. And you're not allowed to have more than 100 nodes in the experiment, but you can do an awful lot by the time you get to there. And once that's done, I could then go and visualize the data and so on from here. Now, if I go back and have a look at, say, something a little more complete, and so we look at the experiments I had. Now, one of the things I've got here is a movie recommender. You'll find, if you know me any length of time, I love movies and stuff. But and so what this one is, it goes through with the IMDb ratings. And so what we have is a whole bunch of movie ratings, and then they've got the movie titles. And what I'm doing is sort of joining that, bringing it down, and then eventually, training, there are training for models, and then what I'm doing from that is then scoring the model, and that's where it goes off and runs the model and tries to build the algorithm to do the prediction. And then eventually what I'm doing with a lot of these ones that I then score, there's also an evaluate, so I can then take out of the known data, I can take some of the data to train the model, some of the data to evaluate the model, and of course I did that by splitting the data back up here, and then I can sort of use the evaluate to go and see if the model's any good and look at the outcome of that and so on. But the idea is I could just build all of this in here and then go off and test it and run things and do what I want inside here. And as I said, you can do that basically for free. Now, once I get all of this functionality the way I want it, I can then save that as a trained model, and that's what I did. Now, and the idea then is I can reuse that as a lump of functionality. And so, for example, here I've then got a web service. And so what I've done is take that piece of functionality in here, and then what I've done then is said, look, I'm going to have a web service input, which is one of the tools, and said, look, if someone calls this from a web service, the data comes in here, goes through here, and comes out the output out the other end. And so I can then publish this as a web service. The other stuff I've got here is so that I can pump test data through it so I can see if it still works, right, the way that I had in mind. And then I can publish this. If I'm a publisher on the Azure Marketplace, I can actually sell this as well, and there are a number of analytics, you know, my wonderful movie recommender. But the thing is, there are people already up there with a bunch of these things for sale. Now, when you do the web service, to also make that easy, so we've got a set of web services here. Just show you the configuration for that. And this is my default endpoint. Now, a couple of things. One is, when I configure this, you get to say, maximum concurrent calls. I'll report that one. Right. And so you can say, how many concurrent calls can you have? But more importantly, the dashboard is sort of interesting. And so the dashboard, this is where we say, look, there are these methods have been built for me. So there's a request response, and there's a way to pump in a batch of data as well. But for example, if I say request response, what it does is it's gone out and automatically built documentation for me, which is just awesome, where it goes and literally builds all the documentation with the methods, shows how to call, documents the parameters, does all the stuff, shows you what the input and output look like, shows you a sample response, and you get down the bottom and they show you the C# code for calling it, and Python, and R. You know, they automatically generate all the calling code for you and so on. So someone who's going to call your web service, they just can go to that web page and have a look and copy in the code they need for doing it. Right? So this is already a very, very complete environment. And as I said, you can try this for free. Worth a look. Now, another one, we're starting to run tighter, but another one I want to mention is Stream Analytics. And this one's interesting. If you look at traditional database applications, it's all been based on, we get a whole bunch of data, we throw it in a database, and then we run queries on it. But the question is, what happens if the data keeps coming faster and faster and faster to the point where you can't put it in the database before you run the queries? Then you've got a problem, right? Now, Stream Insight was designed to try and do that, but it was a set of .NET libraries. Wonderful work they did on it. But people had to then go and build their own infrastructure and everything to make that work. Now, it was designed for really high speed. So you can imagine all the like Internet of Things stuff and all, and then that gets up to a reasonable speed. But imagine if you're wanting to run a query on packets traveling on Ethernet, right? Or things like that. That's a different story entirely. You know, it's like, how could you query data like that? Now, there are people around who want to do that, of course. And you can imagine, but they're mostly being like military and police and, you know, these sorts of things who want to run these sorts of queries. But if you step back from that level of performance and say, okay, well, if we're at the level where there's just a shower of HTTP requests coming and we want to query those, how do we do that? And this is what Stream Analytics is about. And so what it allows you to build is all sorts of connected devices and machines that just throw data at you. It gives you a place to collect that data, to then run queries on the data before you store it, and then to be able to, and combine it with reference data if you want, but then to be able to pick it up and just grab the outcomes of that and push it in. There's a client in Melbourne who does, I was talking to recently, who does retail analytics. And so, for example, the sort of thing they do now is that if you go into a white goods store, every time you open a washing machine lid or open a microwave door, there's a thing going back to here to stream analytics going, somebody opened that door, you know, and so on. And this is the level of what they're doing, because they want to be able to look real time and go, that model's interesting, this model's not, you know, and so on. They want to be able to do that. There's a flood of this sort of data coming from a wide variety of sources. Some of it's almost a little bit spooky as to how far it is, but you can imagine smart grid stuff. As the electricity authorities change over, you know, they've gone from, you know, a reading every 3 months to a reading every 15 minutes. You know, it's like out of every meter in the state. You know, what do you do with that data, right? Now, you may decide to store it all, and I know they all started to try to, but it's going to be interesting to see going forward how that goes. But what is going to happen is you're going to get more and more really high-speed data that you have to make decisions on. Give an example. I was listening to someone, some of the things that we haven't even thought about with autonomous driving vehicles, right? Watching a thing a little while ago where I knew my days of driving are over, and that was when someone was in an autonomous vehicle. They came up to an intersection. The first thing they said, it was really boring, which is exactly what you want. And the second thing was they came up to an intersection and it stopped longer than they would have. And then the final reason was the kid who was riding the push bike on the hedge, behind the hedge, came past and it just saw him with radar and gave way to the kid. You know, like, your days of driving are over, right? You may not realize it yet, but they are. But the thing that gets interesting when you start doing that is they're trying to work out how we start doing microtransactions. So, for example, if you have a whole bunch of cars on the Eastern Freeway in Melbourne, for example, all charging down in the morning and they're all autonomous vehicles, you can start to do things like have an auction between the vehicles as to who's using which lanes, right? And all this sort of stuff in real time, you know, as you're driving, you know? And so you can imagine the flood of data that this sort of stuff is going to start to generate. Anyway, so this is going to be an interesting area going forward. There's just so many areas. Now, what they do here is that you end up, there's a couple of technologies involved. The base one is an event hub. And so an event hub is part of what's called service bus in Azure. And if you think about it for this as just a place where I can set up a messaging hub and I just throw data at it, I mean, basically, and it collects it and holds it for a period of time. The default is it'll hold it for a day. From that, we pick up and run stream analytics jobs that go and grab that data and process it and then push the out, maybe combine it with reference data, but then push the output either into databases or maybe aggregates and so on, or push it across to analytics systems. And so the typical things involved, so we've got some source of events at one end, reference data usually in a some sort of reference database, as I said, a stream of data in the event hub, the analytics query running, and then the outputs that come out the other end. And so an example of this, if you think about like a toll booth on a highway, we could have, say, an entry stream with, you know, here's all the people passing the toll booth. I've got registration data saying this car's this toll number, and then I've got an exit stream saying who's leaving. Now, the way you get to process this data is, again, it's another form of SQL, yet another. And instead of it being .NET code, now it's SQL code, and you write a query in here. So I can say, look, select make from entry stream as yes, but I've said timestamp by. Now the idea here is that every event that comes through, you have some sort of indication of when it occurred. You know, that becomes a really important thing. And then I've done an inner join to another stream of data on a make, and then said where that's happened within 10 minutes, or within 10 seconds in this case. So I could do a query that says, look, find me vehicles that have entered but haven't left again within 5 minutes, right? So it's a left outer join, again, but based on, you know, where I'm simply looking at the timestamps, joining it up, picking up the license plate and saying they haven't exited. Now, what they do with this, they have a variety of windows. It's hard, it takes a while to get your head around the window, but a tumbling window is sort of, in this case, maybe say a 20-second period. Every 20 seconds, it's going to output data based upon the previous 20 seconds. The other type of window is a hopping window, where maybe I say every 20 seconds, it gives you the data for the last 20 seconds, but then it hops just 10 seconds. And so it's always, so sometimes that data is coming out more than once, but you know, give me, say, the average over the last 20 seconds, but give it to me every 10 seconds. And finally, there's a sliding window where it's all based around the event itself. So when this car exited, how many other cars exited within 5 minutes of that, you know, or something like that. But it's based around the time frame of the particular vehicle. Now, let me quickly show you where this is. There is a little bit in the new portal, but not much yet. So the first thing I have is I have a service bus namespace, and in here I create an event hub. And so I have one event hub in here called device readings. What I do with that, there's basically a dashboard, gives you connection strings, things like that. The configuration for it is how long is this retained and whether the event hub itself is enabled. It's also got the ability to partition this to be able to deal with sort of data in parallel as well. And you can build groups of people that consume it. But most of the action happens in the stream analytics. So I have a storage account for that. It's got to have somewhere that it stores the data. And in Stream Analytics, I've got a thing called device temperatures here, which is currently stopped. But the idea with this one is you've got all the sort of monitoring of how much data is going through and things like that. The inputs are where I define where does this thing read data from. And so I've defined one called device readings from Event Hub. And that's a stream of data. And I've said, go off and get this from this Event Hub. And here's the keys I need for getting to it. And oh, by the way, it's JSON, and the one you can't see down the bottom, it's UTF-8 encoded as well. When I have inputs, if I go to add another input, it's either just a data stream or reference data, the choice is there. If I say a data stream, again, I've got a couple of places I can pick this up from. A brand new one this week is IoT Hub. There's always surprises in here, but that appeared, I saw a few days ago. You then define a query, actually the outputs, probably doesn't hurt as well. And so I've got output device readings SQL database. And so in here I've got a connection to an Azure SQL DB is where I'm going to throw the data going out the other end. And then the real action all happens on the query. And so with the query, this is where I've written a query to say, look, select, and notice it's very SQL Server-ish. So select date, add, system timestamps, a little bit different. But system type, device ID, give me an average, give me a count, and so on. But notice the thing down the bottom. So it's group by tumbling window every 5 seconds. And so what this is going to do is output those values every 5 seconds while the job's running. And you can test and run that. Now, the final thing is that when you configure the details of the job, you've also got in here a couple of other things you've got to set. One is dealing with what do you do with events that arrive out of order? And so what you can do is say, look, things might not arrive all at the same time if they're coming from different places. Maybe don't output anything for a minute. Just buffer it all up, rearrange it in the right order, and give it to me, right? You can do that. That'll slow it down starting. And so you've got that sort of tolerance as well. But anyway, so look, it's an interesting thing. If you've got people who are starting to get into, you know, Internet of Things areas, this is an important area. And it's now so easy to set up. Dave Glover has got a thing down in the Maker Den area that'll be on during this week where he's got sort of Internet of Things maker stuff you can go off and try as well. So I encourage you to go and have a look at that. And look, final one I want to mention is just Power BI. This one's taken off pretty rapidly, but it has a role in amongst these services as well. So it allows us to build dashboards, to drill through into underlying reports, and build visualizations over the top of this. But I can do that directly over either on-premises data or things I push up, even still from Excel and so on, or off Azure SQL database. And so connections, they've got applications there for iOS, so iPhone, iPad apps, as well as there's Android ones just starting to appear and Windows Phone apps and so on. Each of the environments that it displays it in, it kind of re-renders it. I'll show you in a sec. So it sort of suits the environment a little bit more. The website is now powerbi.com. It was previously very tied to Office 365. They've now completely decoupled it from that. So if that was a sort of a stumbling block for you early on, this is completely decoupled. And again, you can try this for free. There's a free tier that is excellent. They've got content packs. And what's happening is this: they're adding about one of these a week. So if you have something like, I don't know, MailChimp that you use, there's now an easy way to connect to that. Right? It could connect to Google Analytics and have a look at analytics for the website. You know, any of these things, it kind of feels like a different Microsoft where they're building Google Analytics connectors and things, right? So this is good, actually, and there's a whole raft of this stuff starting to appear. And of course, there's the desktop app as well. And so for development, you've got the desktop app, you've got powerbi.com, you can do a lot directly in the website. You can still build stuff in Excel and publish it from there. That works fine too. And coming up for 2016 is where we get reporting services. We'll be able to take paginated reports and push them up into Power BI as well. And so typically, actually, let me just show you. It's appeared. All right, so let me show you the desktop app first. So Power BI. So desktop app, again, this is a free download, and it encompasses much of what was in Power Pivot, Power Query, Power View the previous Excel add-ins. And so I could open, I've got an example PBIX file that I was building earlier. And this is where I've gone off and sort of grabbed a bunch of data. In fact, let me grab here. And so I've got a set of tables that I've just grabbed and pushed up in here and started to build a data model. I hope most of you have started to play with Power Pivot. If you haven't, this is actually probably a good way to get in and start playing around with it rather than even having to worry about doing it in Excel. And what you then do is you have a series of tables where we then start building out, let's say, products, for example. And I can start going in here and sort of building out, you know, what's going to appear, what's hidden, and so on in the reports over the top. To get the data in here, though, it can either be read directly from somewhere, or we can run a Power Query query. And Power Query allows you to go in and start modifying the data. You know, carve up, knock these words out, divide the columns, create new columns, filter, pivot, all that sort of stuff is part of Power Query. And that allows us to go off and transform the data before it lands inside here. And those same sort of capabilities are present in here. The final thing you do with this is you then start building reports. And so I've built a report here where I've got, this one's a graph, and the color of the graph is just the amount of data. These are actually quite lovely reports. I mean, if I click on this, it also drills into that data as well as showing it to me, the contents of it. These are theaters. You know, I can control click and do it. Like, I mean, it's quite nice in here. You could use this just as a thick client on your own. But look, the more common thing is to then publish this. Now let's go into Power BI. And what I've done is take that desktop app and I've sort of published it up in here. Now, once it gets here, as this is a dashboard that's been built, the same data set is sitting underneath this, and the reports are here, but I've pinned them to a dashboard. And of course, a report could be pinned to more than one dashboard and so on. And the idea is I build a set of dashboards, and this shows the sort of state of these, but again, if I click into this, I can then drill in, and again, you know, this is all, you know, again, click and drill and, you know, do all the things you'd sort of expect here. Also in the dashboard, what's powerful about this, it also has Power Q&A in here. So, for example, if I said, look, total sales by product group, you know, it's like clunk, you know, or total sales was that. If I say, you know, as pie chart, you know, there's a pie chart, you know, and so on. So this is wickedly cool stuff. If you haven't played around with it, I'd so encourage you to do so. There are very few things I've sort of shown CEOs over the last couple of years where they just look and go, I must have that. You know what I mean? It just has that sort of reaction to people. So that actually looks really slick. The other place you can get to this, there's a Power BI app. which is just a lovely Windows app. It's a touch-driven, you know, the whole thing you'd imagine sitting in here. And again, this has samples you can look at, or here's this dashboard. You know, and again, we're back into the same territory. And it's, you know, lovely little spinny things and all sorts of stuff that work much better in that sort of environment. The other place you can get to this is if we go... I haven't got my iPhone connected up, but let me just show you this. So this was off the phone, and so this is, again, presented. It's slightly different, but again, they've laid it out nicely for what was being achieved there. You know, and again, I can drill in, slightly different look, but again, more tailored to what I want inside here. Look, it's a really rich area to be working. Now, the other thing that's important is that when you're building and getting data, there's a really wide variety of places you can now get data from. And so if you spend a bit of time in the Power BI desktop and have a look at the sort of places the data can now come from, as I said, it's very, very rich. And it's not the sort of thing, you know, that you would traditionally have maybe imagined. And so if we look at getting data, like if I look at other, for example, you know, in here, SharePoint lists and Active Directory, you know, go and read AD, go and read my inbox, you know, go and process GitHub or MailChimp or so on, Zendesk, Spark, and so on. This is neat, actually, being able to just go off and connect to these things and pull the data. Actually, it was fascinating just to connect to Facebook, pull your friends down and, and start playing around with it. It's a kind of interesting to have a look at how that there's an amazing amount of data about your friends in Facebook, actually, I might add. I didn't realize that till I connected up and had a look. Yeah, so it's kind of good. But anyway, so look, it is definitely sort of worth a look to sort of get in and give it a shot. All right. Okay, so last couple of things. Other things I'd love you to go and have a look at. Clearly, VMs are still, virtual machines is one of the places you'll still run SQL, and a lot of people will want to pick up and shift and run things in there and totally understand. But I think the future of applications is applications are going to be things that hook together services. They're not going to be things that, you know, run on top of machines that you lift and shift to the cloud. Azure Active Directory, I think you should look long and hard at that because I think it'll be in your future if you're doing data anywhere near any of these areas. Enterprise Key Vault is worth a look. That appeared in the last couple of months. And what this is in SQL Server 2008, they had the introduction of transparent database encryption, but the question is where do the keys live? And they had an option to have extensible key management where you could have a key management system and you could store the keys, but most people don't have those. So this is a key management system as a service. Huh? This is what this is. You can use it both for on-premises ones or more likely for ones in Azure. PowerShell, I think, is in your future. somewhere in amongst there, certainly get used to that. And also get used to the sort of things you can do inside storage. So look, that brings us to time. And so look, there are so many things in there. And I really encourage you, just get and try it, right? I mean, most of the things you can try for free. And you really need to stop and look at your existing apps and just say, where on earth could I start using some of this stuff? Because I really think it'll be part of your future. So